Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
So I'm getting ready to start the recording session, and it's kind of a ritual of mine. I'll go around and I'll shut off all the fans and
the AC.
Turn off the AC, yep. Right, so it doesn't click on in the middle of our recording. And you said, would you mind feeding the dogs? So I said, yeah, sure. So I go over and I pick up their bowls, and there's a little bit of leftover crud in one of the bowls. So I go to empty it in the trash can, but there are no plastic bags in the trash can.
Right, because so I had to wash the trash can.
So I went to get a plastic bag, and there were no plastic bags. So I had to go to the supply closet, and I found an unopened box, and I brought them back, and I opened it, and I put the plastic bag in.
The garbage bag?
Yeah, into the trash can. And then I scraped out the bowls, and then I washed them, and then I fed them, and I forgot totally what I was going to do before that. I got so distracted. So if the AC kicks on, that's why. Also, you might hear Haggis whining a little bit because he blew out his ass.
Oh, yeah. That poor kid. You know, he's just got some real butt issues that we're working through right now. And so he might be whining a little bit, and we're sorry. He is on pain meds.
Also, our neighbor is watching a comedy movie, I guess, and you might hear him laughing.
You won't be able to hear Eddie. He's fine.
Eddie's a good guy.
How are you feeling, by the way?
I'm feeling fine.
You went through a rough patch there.
Well, I had the booster.
Yeah.
You know, the Moderna booster, and the next day I felt like...
How did you put it? You'd been struck, not by a truck, but a... four-door touring sedan.
Yeah.
Because even this, you're feeling so terrible, and you were just like in bed all day, and you were still like coming up with these. I don't know. You're a funny guy. I like you a lot.
Oh, thanks. I like you too. It really wasn't that bad. It just really achy, and I just didn't want to do anything.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you.
So there's a stretch of promenade between the South and North Piers in Blackpool, England.
Promenade.
It's referred to as the Golden Mile. It was late in the 19th century when small-time carnival operators and amusement ride owners and fortune tellers and penny arcade operators, oyster bars, they started popping up in the gardens in the front of boarding houses along the stretch. Mm-hmm. And the reason why was it was an extremely busy area because it led to the Blackpool Central Railway Station, which is no longer there. But the locals decided to take advantage of all the foot traffic and put little shops and amusements in their front gardens.
Oh, okay. Nice. Smart.
Slot machines started popping up. Lots and lots of slot machines. They'd come to saturate the area, and that's how it got its nickname, the Golden Mile. It's actually a little more than a mile. It's about a mile and a half. It's home to Coral Island and the Funland Amusement Arcades today. It's also hosted the official Doctor Who exposition until November of 2009.
Oh, wow.
Over the decades, it's changed and evolved, but in the early 20th century, it was mostly a bizarre world of sideshows. There were many different acts that were exhibited and performed in the sideshows and the freak shows, as they called them back in the day, along the Golden Mile. But in the first half of the 1930s, one act in particular, well, exposition more than an act, dominated the promenade. They were known as the Starving Brides of Blackpool.
Ooh, that doesn't sound good.
During the heyday, they were all that people could talk about. It really became a mania, a craze, a bit of a frenzy. They became so popular that pretty much every seaside resort at one point or another in the 30s had some variation of this exhibit.
It was a starving bride mania?
Yes. But out of all the shows, it was the Starving Brides of Blackpool that made the biggest mark on the British psyche at the time. They were mostly young ladies, mostly brides, either brides-to-be, and some newlyweds. Now, they were given a proposition by a promoter. They were offered large sums of cash to give up eating for several days or even weeks. And then they'd be exhibited while they were fasting in a glass case.
Gross.
Along the promenade. This, of course, was for the pleasure and fascination of the crowds that gathered to watch. But fasting and exhibiting fasters really goes back to just before World War I. It became a bit of a competition.
This makes me very uncomfortable.
Today we have competitive eating. Back then they had competitive fasting. The first record was set by an American, 40 days. And then an Italian took the record to 45 days, a Swiss man, 48, and then an Austrian took the record with 60 days. Now, we don't know for sure how closely these people were monitored, and probably some of this was a fraud.
Oh, yeah.
But many were not. In the summer of 1929, a small amusement arcade on Church Street in Blackpool became the hotbed for a renaissance of exhibiting fasters. A promoter whose name was Luke Gannon was pulling in huge crowds in the back of the premises behind tall screens. Visitors would come in, they'd pay their money, they would be led to the rear of the arcade, and there they found a glass case. In the glass case contained a man who looked pale and painfully thin. His name was Ricardo Sacco. Mr. Sacco had been a farmer and a baker in his earlier days, but at one point got hooked into this competitive fasting thing. He referred to himself now as a professional fasting man.
First of all, so dangerous and gross. And like how, I mean, basically they were being paid to be anorexic.
It was looked at as a feat of endurance.
That's terrible.
Ricardo Sacco made it 65 days before he threw in the towel. He said, I can't go anymore. And there was another guy who was kind of racing him, if you will, I guess. He lasted 67 days. But Ricardo lasted 65. And then he went home.
And died?
3 weeks later.
Yes.
Yeah, he died. It was heart failure due to,
of course,
malnutrition. A couple of years after this tragedy in Blackpool, Luke Gannon, the promoter, thought it'd be a good idea to bring this stunt back.
Ugh.
But this time with young girls.
Oh, this makes me so uncomfortable.
The first starving bride of Blackpool likely was a young lady named Joyce Heather. It was the summer of 1931. She was promised by Gannon £200 if she would forego eating and sit in a barrel with a glass top on it for 10 days.
Sit in a barrel with a glass top on it for 10 days?
Yeah.
Like, could she get out to use the facilities and such? Did she get to shower?
Unclear. I don't think so.
Okay.
But Joyce, unlike Mr. Sacco, was an amateur. Her goal was the 10 days. She made it to 9 and then gave up. One day to go to get her £200 and she gave up. There was some widespread public suspicion, and according to reports of the day, that suspicion quickly turned to anger, and an angry mob tipped the barrel over and rolled it into the ocean. But being the sort of man that Gannon was, he never said die, at least not for himself. He was back the following year with a new woman named Nellie Hayes, and also a defrocked vicar named Harold Davidson. So he had two of them going at once.
So these are people who are desperate for money.
Yes.
Who he is paying to starve themselves.
Right. And he would prey on young women especially, or newlyweds, because they needed cash. They were just starting out as a married couple. In Harold Davidson's case, he had been a vicar and had been defrocked, and he wished to protest the Church of England by doing this, and in the process raise money to mount a legal challenge against his defrocking. So they were both put in barrels and exhibited, but this time at Luke Gannon's house on Central Beach, in a location where the Funland Arcade now stands. And this caused quite a stir. And then newlyweds started flocking to the promoter, begging to be part of this.
Ew. It's just so gross, and it really, it's not too different than what we do to models, you know, these days.
Interesting.
You know, there's these young women who want to break into the industry, and over again, they're told, like, you're too fat, you're too fat, you're too fat, too fat, and they feel like they have to essentially put themselves in a barrel with a glass top for 9 days in order to make it.
Different premise, but same result.
Yeah.
There was a promotional bill that said, quote, brides and bridegrooms straight from the altar, starve for 30 days. What courage? Will they do it?
Why? Like, what's... Okay, is the draw that they are super gaunt? I'm sorry, am I getting worked up? I'm sorry. Is it that they're like gaunt and skinny and it's interesting to see their bodies, you know, destroyed this way? Or is it just that they've done it for so long? It's like, wow, look at that. They're in the midst of this event.
Gotta be both. But I think without question, the underlying draw or attraction is morbid fascination. Ugh. You're watching people that are slowly dying. And the reason they did this was because he offered £250, which is about 18,000 pounds in today's money.
Hey Siri.
How much is 18,000 pounds in US?
18,000 British pounds is $24,160 and 10 cents.
So you can see why these people were lining up to do it.
But your heart though.
Yeah.
Your heart and your hair is going to fall out, right. Your teeth are going to fall. I mean,
so several of them were exhibited at once. They were placed in glass cases, separated from each other, both the bride and the groom, but all the attention seemed to go to the bride. That's what they marketed, the starving brides, even though there were some grooms there. They would wear a white wedding gown, and they referred to her glass case as a coffin.
Sure.
A woman named Barbara McDonald took up the challenge and went on display. She had been married for just 2 hours. And to emphasize this point, they put her three-tiered wedding cake right outside the case, which I'm thinking, she's in there starving and you're putting fresh, delicious pastry within. That's just taunting
Well,
her.
That's what I was thinking about, that guy who used to be a baker. And it's like, were you not tempted by your own craft? Speaking of which, I'm going to make some bread today and I'm super excited about it. I'm thinking like garlic basil. Okay, please continue reading your story. I won't interrupt again.
No, I love it when you interrupt.
It's fine.
Mrs. McDonald told a reporter, quote, "It'll be a constant reminder of what depends on my success." That must have been torture. After like 7-8 days, no food, and there's this delicious cake right outside your glass coffin.
Yeah, your dress could be a reminder. Though after 9 days, maybe you're going to eat that. I don't know.
Well, it's high in fiber. So Gannon's show became a craze, a mania, and of course that just encouraged other promoters to do it. There were two others in the area, one at the arcade called the White House and the other at the Trocadero. And so there were three newlywed brides in glass cases. The beautiful, bold, colorful sign outside of one said, quote, "The lovely bride lies here starving. The pluckiest girl in the world now lies in a coffin." People lined up to see it.
Did anyone try to feed her?
I'm sure they did. And a lot of people commented on that. They would put up blackboards outside of the arcades where they would, the owners would go out and write urgent bulletins on them in chalk like, quote, "Starving bride, sinking fast." They also posted, they put bouncers outside the doors who would yell at passersby. Things like, "Hey, don't waste your chance. She might be gone tomorrow."
Ew.
And if you did take him up on it, you'd pay 2 pence, and then you would be taken behind a curtain into a darkened room. The coffins were just under 8 feet long, 3 feet wide, and about 4 feet high, and they had a glass top that you could look down and see the starving bride inside. Now, the bride would be lying down, and besides an occasional twitch of the face or a blink of an eye behind her veil, they would barely move, for obvious reasons. The shows grew tremendously over the summer in popularity. A newspaper article quoted one of the bouncers saying, quote, "You would be flabbergasted if you came here on the weekend. On Saturday and Sunday, we have queues of people waiting to come in." So the reporter went in. He commented on what he saw in line. He said he saw a man in a well-cut suit wearing a monocle and carrying a leather briefcase. Also, two girls who were giggling and laughing. And a woman from Lancashire nodded toward the bride and said, quote, "I'd rather pay 2 pence to see her fed."
Right.
She had the right idea. Now, clearly not everybody was a big fan of these starving bride exhibits. The weekly magazine John Bull called them, quote, "blatant and idiotic vulgarity."
Yeah.
Another vicar who was still frocked sent a message to his home office describing what he called a nauseating spectacle. This started to anger local council members. But it was a combination of these things going on. It wasn't just, it was the Golden Mile, but it wasn't just the starving brides exhibit, but it was also the endless nonstop piano playing, because marathon piano playing had also become a craze at the same time.
Oh, okay.
So you had like these starving young women in glass coffins, and then people who would not shut the fuck up by playing piano 24/7. In April of 1935, there was an arcade on Central Beach, and a guy calling himself Syncopating Sandy set a record with over 122 hours of nonstop piano playing. He never got up for 122 hours. Wow. And again, I don't know how he managed to go to the bathroom. I'm sure he devised some sort of system involving tubes and a pail. But he did talk about, or they did in the article, they talked about how he washed himself. He would continue playing with one hand while he washed himself up every day. Maude Collins had set a record for nonstop piano playing for women, 50 hours. With all the crowds, the starving brides, and the piano playing, it drew crowds 24 hours a day, nonstop. There was a guy named Mr. Fryer, whose house on Barney Street backed up against the arcades. He had had enough. Quote, "The piano playing has been going on at night for about 2 weeks. It's been impossible for me to get any sleep. I have been on the promenade at 4 o'clock in the morning." So at a conference in Blackpool in October, one politician not only denounced the nonstop piano playing, but described the starving bride exhibit as, quote, "perfectly horrid, unchristian, and beastly."
I would agree.
So the following day, Town Hall held a meeting. The magistrates' chief constable made a tour of the arcades, informing them that they must close. Two of them did, but not Luke Gannon. He said they had no power to shut him down. It was on his own property. He said that his subjects had been examined by a doctor. They'd been given a drink of milk. Quote, "They'll remain there for 9 more days, completing the 30 days. And at the end, I will give them the £250. I will give it to them even if it skins me." So when he failed to close up his shop, others opened theirs back up again.
Sure.
But they found a bit of a loophole. The starving brides at their arcades had thrown the towel in once things closed down. So they promoted it that the bride was too ill to be taken from her glass case, but you could pay to come in and watch her eat eggs and brandy.
Okay.
In 1934, authorities were granted power by a special act of parliament. Now they could insist that all showmen get a license. It also gave them the power to ban any sideshow they didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, it allowed them to control the ice cream industry and holiday camps.
Oh.
I'm not sure why.
Okay.
Starving brides and piano marathons were now a thing of the past. But Luke Gannon didn't stop. He sent an urgent cable to the Empress of Abyssinia. Now, she had just finished a political fast to protest Italy's invasion of her country.
Okay.
He invited her to repeat that feat in Blackpool to, quote, avert the calamity of world war. And he said if she wanted to, he could use his arcade on Central Beach for that purpose. It's pretty nice of him to offer that. Yeah. He'd be more than happy to make it available to her. She declined the offer. And that was the end of the Starving Brides of Blackpool and marathon piano playing.
Wow.
For that matter. My sources of information, the Blackpool Gazette, The Guardian, and Wikipedia. There were lots of crazy crazes back then. Flagpole sitting, phone booth stuffing. In the 50s, I know you hate this idea. Swallowing goldfish was a big craze.
It's annoying.
Why do people do stupid things?
I don't know.
Money? Fame?
Sure.
I don't know. Anyway, there you go. Starving Brides of Blackpool.
Well, that was upsetting.
You're welcome.
And now, that thing in the middle. Back in the 60s, a merchant marine named John Chicky Donahue found himself in a port right outside of Vietnam. He had heard that three of his buddies had enlisted back home and were somewhere in the war zone. So to show support to his friends, he snuck into the war zone to find them. Why? To bring them several cases of beer that he smuggled in. It's known as the greatest beer run ever. And there's a documentary that's been made about it.
If you played this podcast backward and at twice the speed, it would sound like crap. This is the Box of Oddities.
You hear Kat and I talk a lot about Aura frames, and there's a reason for that. We live in Ecuador, and our family is all over the place. In fact, Kat right now is up visiting her mom, and when I say up, I mean Maine. We got her an Aura frame so we could share photos and videos from any device, and they'll instantly appear on the frame, which makes it easy because she's getting up there in years. It's easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app, and it's the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app, and if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. It is the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get 30% off free shipping and their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com, and use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Box of Oddities with Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth.
Pete from Australia sent us an email. Hey guys, just listened to the tree kangaroo episode. Great as always. Thought you might find this interesting. Did you know kangaroos don't fart?
No.
Weird as you would think with all that bouncing around, you'd be farting more than bingo night at an old person's home. Scientists have identified an enzyme in the kangaroo's gut that is the reason for the lack of bottom burps. They're investigating putting the enzyme into cows to reduce the impact of global warming that cattle has with their massive releases of methane through farting. Just a freaky fact for you, how Aussies are helping the world one less fart at a time. Stay freaky. Keep up the good work. Freaky Pete from Down Under. Thanks, Freaky Pete.
I love it.
If you are, in fact, a real person and not just an actor.
Right.
Because we all know that Australia
is not real.
Not real. Do you have a story for me, my love?
I do.
Would you mind sharing it with me now?
Thomas Hogg was a servant from New Haven Colony, and he was not well-liked in the community. It's the winter of 1645, and he was awaiting trial for theft, dishonesty, and indecent exposure.
Oh.
So he was known to tootle about town with his bits showing through his breeches. Now, it turns out he actually had a pretty painful inguinal hernia, I think that's how you pronounce it, which he described as it being his belly was broke, according to the records of the colony and plantation of New Haven. So he wore a steel truss to keep his hernia in check, and the truss would often tear holes in the crotch of his pants, leading to sometimes his meat and two veg being on display.
My goodness.
However, it seemed that when this took place, he wasn't fast to repair the situation, or sometimes he just didn't notice, or he just acted like it wasn't a big deal. But I suppose after it happening over and over again, you've got to be like, well, what, you know, sorry.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think it was just the hernia that people were seeing and not the bits.
Maybe wear the truss on the outside, you know, because if it does tear your pants, then at least you're still covered with the truss.
I don't know if it would work that way, but it's a good suggestion. Many of the people in this community, though, were not into Thomas Hogg. They were very off-put by his genital peekery and his general existence, right?
Off-put by his genital peekery.
So one day this winter, the wife of a prominent sea captain in New Haven went out to her property to check on her pigs. One of her sows was pregnant and she wanted to see how she was doing. And it turns out that this sow had given birth, but not to regular little cute little piglets, right? Instead to, quote, two monsters. One had fair white skin, and the other had a head like a child's and a protuberant right eye. Now, the sea captain's wife was very upset, and the town council was summoned. And before long, everyone came to the conclusion that the malformed piglets looked just like Thomas Hogg.
Well, his name was Hogg.
Right. So, obviously.
Is that where we got the term hog?
I don't think so. At this time in New England, there was some frenzy about bestiality.
Okay, well, understandable, but it's quite a leap to, like, say, yeah, there's a guy with a hernia and his soft dangly parts hanging out to, you know, doing it with a sow.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind that Thomas also probably suffered from Graves' disease. So he did have eyes that protruded a little bit from his sockets. And so he wasn't, you know, a fine-looking fellow.
He was all messed up.
He was just not doing great as far as the gene pool goes. And the town people just didn't like him. Now, as I said, in New England at this time, people were kind... It was kind of like the Salem witch trials, but with bestiality.
Okay.
Now, I want to make clear, there are few things that anger me more than bestiality. I, at no point during this story, am making light of it or saying it's not a big deal or anything like that, because honestly, I cannot think of anything worse. Nope, that's not true, but I can't think of many things that are worse. There were so many cases of accusations in this surrounding area, actually, that the magistrate justified it by saying, okay, well, yeah, we all came from England, and it's not that we have more people, quote unquote, buggering animals in New England than we did in England, but we're much more fervent in cracking down on it. So it's not that we are you know, just randomly accusing people in the town of doing this, or that there are more people doing this. It's just that we're better about finding out about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Puritan investigators would, they had this interesting way of determining what went on in a situation by forcing defendants of murder, sometimes rape, bestiality, etc., to confront their victims if possible. They were hoping that a reenactment of the crimes might catalyze a confession. So they brought Thomas to the pig farm and ordered him to scratch the sow under the ear, at which point the investigators determined that there appeared to be the working of lust in the sow.
Oh my. So they're able to somehow sense whether that made the pig horny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was then ordered to scratch another sow who didn't seem interested. And so that obviously was clear evidence that one sow had been approached by Thomas Hogg and the other had not. So at this point, Thomas Hogg admitted, yeah, this looks bad. Which is just bananas. But he remained defiant. And he said, I have never had to doe with either sow. Now, I'm not familiar with this kind of language. I assume that means I did not have my way. Okay. Of course, no one had witnessed him with the sea captain's wife's pig, or any pig for that matter. But it was super frustrating for the investigators because they really wanted to hang this guy. So instead, he was convicted of lying and stealing, and he was sentenced to a severe whipping and hard labor.
Lying about what?
Oh, something else.
Okay.
As I said, he was not popular among the town folk. But Hogg got off easy. Please excuse my phrasing. George Spencer did not. 5 years before the Hogg trial, George Spencer lived also in New Haven Colony and was referred to as a habitual troublemaker. Spencer also suffered from physical impairments. He was described by his neighbors as very ugly. He was balding and he wore a glass eye. Worst of all, he was openly not a man of faith.
Okay. All right. Well, I can see, you know, the glass eye and not a man of faith thing being translated in those days into a constant troublemaker.
So you can, I mean, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So you can see how obviously when a sow gave birth to a malformed piglet, all eyes were cast to George Spencer. Quote, the monster was come to the full growth as other pigs, but brought forth dead. It had no hair on its whole body. The skin was very tender and of white color, like a child's. The head was most strange. It had one eye.
Okay.
So, naturally, Spencer was arrested.
Well, of course.
And the Puritan authorities believed that this one-eyed piglet was irrefutable evidence that an act of bestiality had taken place. And Spencer was told, if he that confesseth and forsaketh his sins shall find mercy. But it wasn't made clear to him whether that mercy came from the court or if mercy came from God.
I'd want it in writing.
Yeah.
Well, spell it out.
Right.
You know.
Clarify, por favor.
Never trust a 17th century plea bargain.
Well, George Spencer did. And on the realization that it might lead to a death sentence if he didn't confess, he did confess to fathering these malformed piglets.
Good God.
But then, of course, everyone got all jacked up about the situation and were very jazzed about killing him. So then he was like, oh, wait, so you didn't mean that the mercy would come from the court, I will still be subjected to the death penalty. So he retracted his statement because obviously he was not the father of these piglets. That's not how it works. So throughout the case being investigated, he confessed and retracted his statements several times based on what the people were telling him would keep him from being murdered, basically.
Sure, sure.
Now, at this time, the courts needed two witnesses to a crime in order to proceed. But like I said, George Spencer was not popular amongst the town folk and, again, didn't believe in God. So they used one of his retracted confessions as a witness.
What? How?
The second witness was the stillborn piglet.
Okay.
So, I mean, obviously, we've got everything we need right here. Mm-hmm. The court was abundantly satisfied of Spencer's guilt and the correctness of his sentence. So it was ordered that Spencer should be hanged.
Wow.
Not before, though, the sow that gave birth to those mutant piglets was stabbed with a sword. The pig was to be slain, and then he's to be hanged. And that sentence was carried out on April 8, 1642. And Spencer's death was very early in the history of Connecticut and reported to be only the second execution to take place.
Good God.
While researching just these two stories, I came across several other stories of exactly this thing. It was said that so-and-so, you know, did it with a turkey, and so let's kill him. And it happened all over New England for a period of time where they were just real jazzed about murdering people for the accusation of this kind of business. And often people would be charged with the suspicion of something.
And could you be executed if found guilty of being suspected to do something?
If they could find witnesses, and or, as we've seen here, that doesn't mean anything.
A dead pig.
Right.
We'll do it. Wow. Holy shit. Nowadays, you can just buy your way out of anything.
Not if you're poor and unattractive, though.
That's true. Silly me.
So that is, I don't even know what to call that, the trial of Thomas Hogg, or the murder of George Spencer, or the bestiality frenzy of New England. I'm not sure.
Make up your own episode title.
Either way, it's awful. I got my information from theall.com, of course, Wikipedia, alphahistory.com, and slate.com.
Oh, real quick, do you have the names of our most recent patrons?
I do. Alexandra, who, by the way, profile picture on Patreon is of a manatee, and I love it dearly. Andrea, Kathy, and Letitia.
And just so you know, the Live in New York video is available now for you patrons. Hopefully you'll enjoy it, but we make no promises.
Oh, no. Fingers crossed, though.
If you're not a patron and you want to become one, just go to theboxofoddities.com and click on the Support the Show link. And please tell your freaky friends about The Box of Oddities, available on all major podcasting platforms, including Amazon Music. We'll see you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
Fly it proudly, you beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that The Box of Oddities belongs to you, and its fate is in your hands. Henceforth, the Box of Oddities commits to the telling of stories. Stories of the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. TheBoxOfOddities.com. On Facebook at Facebook.com/Box of Oddities Podcast. On Twitter at Box of Oddities. And Instagram at Box of Oddities Podcast. Copyright 2021. All rights reserved.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ plus royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.